Recipes for Life podcast is a conversation about my favorite ingredients for a healthy human experience. We take an informed look at topics that include nutritional and emotional well-being, as well as expanded consciousness. If you would like to become a qualified health coach, then the Institute for Integrative Nutrition, or IIN for short, can help you achieve your goals. I completed their health coaching course many years ago, which has been one of the catalysts for my own journey into what I now love to do, which is to help people achieve greater health through the sharing of information through my books, seminars, podcasts, TV shows and films. I recommend IIN for anyone wishing to pursue a career in the health coaching and wellness space. IIN is a one-year course, so that if you're a full-time worker, busy parent, or wherever you are in your life, it is flexible enough so you'll be able to complete all the required curriculum. Please see the link included in the podcast show notes or my website to access the free sample class and first module of their program. This will give you a great taste of the format as well as the structure, and you can also utilize my special discount that I can offer you if you decide to sign up. Make sure you tell the admissions team that you're part of the Pete Evans Tuition Savings to claim your very substantial discount. Please visit integrativenutrition.com or email admissions@integrativenutrition.com. Dr. Asim Malhotra is an award-winning cardiologist. He is becoming known as one of the most influential cardiologists in Britain and a world-leading expert in the prevention, diagnosis, and treatment of heart disease. Dr. Asim Malhotra is successfully leading the campaign against excess sugar consumption. The award-winning NHS cardiologist has successfully motivated leading academics, the media, and politicians to make sugar reduction a health priority in the UK by publishing commentaries in the BMJ and mainstream media. When he's not working as a doctor in the National Health Service, Asim Malhotra reigns supreme in his fight to raise awareness about the health benefits of a sugar-free diet, maintaining that sugar deserves its reputation as public health enemy number one. His no-holds-barred approach to challenging common health beliefs is proving highly effective in getting medical professionals and social authorities from around the world to sit up and take notice. He's regularly invited to speak at national and international conferences. To find out more about Dr. Asim, visit drasim.com. That's drasim.com. Asim, it is so fantastic to have you on the program, and it's been a while since we last chatted, and you have been a very busy man. And what I love about you is you have that never give up attitude, and you are really determined to change the guidelines, not only in the UK, but probably the world as as well. And first and foremost, let's talk about who you are and explain to us what a cardiologist actually does.
You know, Pete, no, thank you. I think first and foremost, my journey over the last several years started with and continues to be inspired by my patients. Ultimately, I'm a consultant cardiologist. I graduated as a medical doctor almost 17 years ago in 2001. And over many years, I noticed there was more and more stress on the system. There were more people coming in with more chronic diseases. There was more obesity, more misery, basically, Pete. And I predicted many years ago that if we carry on as we are, then our health systems are going to, you know, our NHS in the UK, and I was seeing also similar things happening abroad, that our health systems are going to collapse. And also, you know, at the same time, people were becoming more unhealthy and more miserable. So initially for me, it actually started with, you know, trying to get involved to do what I could in my own way to help tackle the obesity epidemic. And I think one of the sort of light bulb moments for me was when I was working as a cardiology specialist registrar. So I trained in interventional cardiology, essentially doing keyhole heart surgery on patients. And one of the patients I operated on in the middle of the night, who came in with a heart attack, and we saved him. You know, when I was on the ward round the next morning and trying to talk to him about, you know, quitting smoking and taking the medications we were going to prescribe for him and following a healthy diet, he gets served a burger and fries. And he says to me, "Doc, how do you expect me to change my lifestyle if you're serving me the same crap that brought me in here in the first place?" And Pete, I've always been actually a really big sort of someone who's, I would call myself a foodie. You know, I I valued the importance of good food. I learned to cook from my dad when I was a teenager. And one thing I'd already noticed up to that point is that, you know, the kind of food that was being served to staff and patients in hospitals was pretty atrocious. So I actually, after that experience with our patient, I thought, you know what, we need to sort hospital food out. I mean, we're talking about an obesity epidemic, but actually a lot of our staff are overweight or obese, and we're just serving junk food in hospitals as well. So I thought, you know, we need to really start by setting an example. So the first thing I did one afternoon is I actually wrote an email. I got the email address from a friend of mine, of the PA of Jamie Oliver. And I wrote an email to Jamie and said, listen, I think you've done great stuff highlighting, you know, school food and improving school food and trying to tackle child obesity. You know, we need to sort hospitals out as well. And to my pleasant surprise, several weeks later, I got a reply basically from Jamie's PA saying, Jamie would be thrilled to meet you. Why don't you come over and have dinner with a few of the doctors? And eventually I did meet him. And, you know, I've met him several times and, you know, he's a great guy. So we had a long discussion about what needed to be done to tackle obesity. And this is 2010. And then shortly after that, in 2011, I wrote a piece in the Observer newspaper, which I couldn't have predicted had quite a big impact. It became a front page comment piece in the Observer. And, you know, the title of that piece was I Mend Hearts, Then I See Our Hospitals Serve Junk Food to Our Patients. So really sort of setting the stall out, saying, guys, you know, the medical profession needs to sort this out as well. So that's where things started for me, Pete. And then, you know, over the course of time, I then realized that actually that the obesity problem, irrespective of dietary guidelines, which we can come on to, is essentially a problem of the food environment. You know, it's become unavoidable processed foods. The default choice has become ultra processed foods, not good, healthy food. And to then tackle that, we then need to tackle the environment through policy changes. So then I started working with various organizations at, you know, quite a high level. First of all, getting the medical royal colleges of the UK. I worked with them as part of a group that looks into evidence of what needs to be done to tackle obesity. And I really pushed the junk food ban in hospitals and also, you know, really pushed that we should get a call for a sugary drinks tax. And then they came out in 2012 with this plan, which made, you know, BBC News headlines and front page of the Guardian newspaper, really saying that, you know, taxing sugar drinks, banning junk food advertising, getting junk food out of hospitals needs to be a priority if we're going to tackle obesity. And then I've just really been on a journey where, you know, I've also, I think, discovered, Pete, and I know, you know, you've known this for a long time, is that really the impact on diet on health is very profound. You know, we have sort of ignored or been ignorant to the science of actually how food really impacts on chronic disease. And in fact, much of the chronic disease, if you look at it now around the world, whether it's heart disease, type 2 diabetes, even high blood pressure, you know, much, if not most of that is coming from lifestyle. And within lifestyle, diet is probably the most important factor. So really the solutions to solving our healthcare crisis must put diet really at the very top of the management plan, if you like, not just for populations, but just for individual patients as well.
So tell me about the work that you're doing at the moment, because you're campaigning against Parliament or to Parliament and to the government about how you can actually, or collectively with your friends and colleagues, how we can actually make a shift. You're starting at the UK. So tell us about that campaign that you're running at the moment, please.
Yeah, so Pete, I think there are a number of things. I think one of the things first and foremost is that I helped form a campaign group called Action on Sugar, which launched in 2014. And it had come on the back of me writing a number of papers in the British Medical Journal. First of all, exonerating saturated fat as a cause of heart disease. And that, you know, that had quite a big impact internationally, but saying we should focus on sugar. And I think because the media picked up, that you know, the politicians started to pay attention, especially, you know, interestingly, you know, a newspaper that one would consider sort of slightly right wing and probably one that would not necessarily support regulation really came behind you know, our calls for, you know, a sugar tax. And, you know, the Daily Mail basically on the front page put sugar as a new tobacco. And when that happened, I think that we were already in a situation where, you know, we were, you know, I think at a tipping point where the awareness had really started to impact the public, influencing public opinion. Obviously, politicians listen to public opinion. And then when we launched Action on Sugar a few months later, which again became a big news story. We got support from, first and foremost, actually, the man who was the chair of the all-party, and still the all-party diabetes group in Parliament, which is a cross-party group called Keith Vaz. And Keith Vaz, out of the unpredictably, I had spoken to Keith at length and he had supported the work I was doing. But he came out and he actually officially put a motion in Parliament saying that we need to get behind Dr. Malhotra and his colleagues and really support this cause for reduction of sugar consumption across the population. And so, you know, many members of Parliament signed up to that. And I think that was really a tipping point for political action. And then, you know, only a couple of years later, Pete, as you know, this came into action in, you know, it was announced in 2016. And we literally just a few weeks ago started a sugary drinks tax in the UK. So I think that my realization was, you know, I needed to, you know, and I would go to Parliament, I would meet politicians, I would have conversations with them, because this, for me, the evidence and science is very clear what needs to be done to tackle obesity. But I think a lot of people are not aware of it and they just need to hear it, Pete. And, you know, I have, in my own way with many other people, I would, you know, speak at conferences and, you know, speak to the medical establishment and get the media on board. Ultimately, I think the media have a major role to play, Pete, because if the media get behind this, then obviously the public awareness spreads and then the politicians also become aware. And one of the parallels we also drew, I think, is that, you know, that much of the behavior of the food industry and the sugar industry is very similar to what tobacco did for many years to stall any interventions that, you know, reduced tobacco consumption. And ultimately that was through regulation, Pete. It was taxing cigarettes. It was banning, you know, tobacco advertising. It was a public education campaign about how harmful cigarettes were. So we could learn from that. The only thing we don't have time. We don't have decades to wait for regulation, because actually it was about 50 years between the first links between smoking and lung cancer were published in the BMJ before there was any effective action in terms of, you know, public smoking bans and things, because tobacco really played dirty. You know, they denied cigarettes were harmful. They planted doubt. They confused the public. Even bought the loyalty of scientists and academics who would write articles saying actually smoking isn't harmful or that harmful. So we've seen similar things happen and we need to learn from history. So I think part of also that campaign and awareness is to highlight that as well, you know, that unfortunately in healthcare right now, and what I spoke about in the European Parliament recently, is that there is too much commercial influence, Pete. In modern medicine, I'm about to go and give a talk this afternoon to 500 general practitioners whose practices cover a population in Greater London of 10 million people. And I'm going to tell them that you cannot drug people into being healthier. And actually, our healthcare system has been corrupted by commercial influence and no amount of money will fix it. You know, we have the solutions now, but what we need to do ultimately is that we need a national and global campaign to reduce the amount of medications people are taking, which really for most people to have no benefit and come with side effects, and really push lifestyle to the forefront. And if we do that, Pete, the quicker we do that, the sooner we'll have healthier and happier populations.
You've been very vocal about statins. And I'd love to explore this with you a little bit more, because I've never really spoken about this on the podcast before. And I know so many people that are interested in this topic. So who better to talk about it than a qualified cardiologist, a clinical cardiologist that has a great history with this and can spread some information. Over to you, Doctor.
Thanks, Pete. I'm glad you've asked me this question because I think it's still a very, very important topic and issue. So when we talk about statins, first and foremost, I want to say that I'm not against statins per se, but I'm against lack of transparency in their prescription. And across the board for decades, and it still exists now, there is a huge lack of transparency. So let me try and correct some of that misinformation that's out there. The first thing is the reason statins were originally prescribed were because of the, you know, belief that high cholesterol was a really important risk factor for heart disease. And the lower you get your cholesterol, because of how statins work, they lower cholesterol in the bloodstream, you're going to reduce your chances of having a heart attack. A couple of things first to say is that we now realize that cholesterol is not the important risk factor that we used to think it was. I'm not saying it's not a risk factor at all, but there is some evidence to suggest it's a very weak one and certainly shouldn't be the primary focus of prevention of heart disease, because, you know, 3 decades campaign to try and lower cholesterol through drugs or diet has failed to curb heart disease. And one of the reasons it's failed is because the original hypothesis that cholesterol was a very important risk factor was fatally flawed. And for the overwhelming majority of people, cholesterol is not a risk factor for heart disease. So that's the first thing to say. The second thing to say is when you look at the data on statins, and Pete, we have to take some of this really with a pinch of salt, because most of the data, if not all of the data on statins, is it comes from industry-sponsored trials. And we're talking about a drug now that's one of the most prescribed drugs in the history of medicine. It's been one of the most lucrative drugs for drug companies. You know, it's been, you know, it's driven a multi-million, multi-billion dollar industry, if you like, for cholesterol lowering, statins being at the heart of that. When you look at the actual data, what does it tell us? So first and foremost, for people with heart disease, people who have had heart attacks, we know that for an individual, and this is where most people were, you know, most people are not given this information. And by the way, I'm about to speak to a number of GPs today, 500 GPs in London-wide conference for GPs. They have a catchment population of their practices covering almost 10 million people. And I'm going to talk about this and to say that to not have this conversation, which I'm about to tell you, with your patient really is unethical. You are practicing unethical medicine unwittingly because you're not being transparent with the information so that patients can make an informed decision. So if you look at heart attack patients taking a statin every day for 5 years, and this is best case scenario because these are selected patients in trials that often don't represent people in the real world. So people, for example, who are less likely to suffer side effects are the ones that are in the trials. And partly because the trials are designed to pick up those people who are less likely to get side effects. And also, people in many of the trials were who had side effects at the beginning in a what we call a run-in period before the official trial started were taken out of the trial because of side effects, most likely. So you really, you know, you now got a very selected group of people. What does that selected group of people tell us about the benefits of statins? So this is best case scenario. If you've had a heart attack, there's a 1 in 83 chance of taking a statin every day religiously for 5 years will delay or prevent your death. And about 1 in 39 chance, Pete, it will prevent a non-fatal heart attack. If you haven't got heart disease, if you're low risk, if you're otherwise healthy, you haven't had a heart attack, then actually look at the totality of the evidence. It's not going to prolong your life by one day. There's no mortality benefit. There's a very small benefit, less than 1% of it preventing a non-fatal heart attack, a heart attack or a non-serious or, you know, a minor stroke. But it will not prolong your life by one day. And how many patients are given that information? We estimate that probably most of the people taking statins around the world right now, Pete, and probably around 100 million people taking statins, most of those people come into the low-risk category. How many of those people do you think actually know that them taking a statin every day religiously is not going to prolong their life? I suspect very few. Mm-hmm. But that's what the data tells us. And, you know, really, to be honest, when you reflect on it, it is really quite scandalous that we haven't given that information in a transparent way to patients. And some of that is because of clever marketing by the drug industry, and some of it's misleading statistics. But ultimately, that's what the data tells us. So my personal view, unless you have a genetic condition, which affects, you know, less than 1 in 100 people where you have genetically very high cholesterol, unless you're in that particular category or you've had a heart attack, taking statins, in my view, is really potentially very harmful, because a lot of these patients who come in, who take a statin, they have this illusion of protection. So people think they're taking this pill, everything's about lowering cholesterol, and they don't pay any attention to their lifestyle. And in fact, you know, many of those people think it's an excuse to go and gorge on junk food, or they don't need to exercise. And actually, if you think about that and you take that into context, there is a net harm for that patient if he thinks that taking a statin is going to actually, you know, prolong his life or have a significant impact on reducing the risk of heart disease while simultaneously doing all the other things, which are way more important. So my personal view is this, is that if someone wants to take a statin with a small benefit, you know, a discussion with a patient, that's absolutely fine. That's an honest, ethical way of practicing medicine. That's about shared decision making. It's about putting patient preferences first. But I would say personally, for me, I would put lifestyle at the forefront. And, you know, and the other thing to say about statin side effects, Pete, and there's been a lot of controversy about that. I think there's different data saying different things, but in general, in my experience, and to be fair, most of these side effects are reversible. About probably 1 in 5, maybe 1 in 3 patients at some point will experience a side effect that interferes with the quality of their life taking a statin. Most commonly, it's muscle pain and fatigue, but other things that I've seen in patients include things like, you know, stomach upset, you know, memory disturbance, especially in the elderly, erectile dysfunction. And we now know that there is a strong link between taking statins and the development of a neurological condition called ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, in the long term. So I think there are all these other issues that still need to be discussed, and there is a legitimate debate to be had. But I'll tell you what's really interesting, Pete, and this is before any media hype. So this is before any awareness, you know, that some people say, oh, this scaremongering on statins, are people going to stop them and have heart attacks and that kind of thing. If you go as far back, you know, many, many years, one of the largest statin surveys that was done in the United States showed that in the community, more than, you know, about 75% of patients prescribed statins will stop taking them within a year. And when you survey these patients and ask them why they stopped, most of them said it was because of side effects. Now, what's really interesting is, and I've been on the coalface as a clinical cardiologist who's prescribed statins like Smarties, is that I've never mentioned side effects to patients when I prescribed a statin. I've said, this is literally a magic pill. You must take this religiously. It will save your life. So the question is, why are these patients all stopping their statins if they're being given that information and not mentioned that there are side effects? Because some people are arguing that people are imagining side effects. These side effects are very, very rare. It's not true. It's clearly not true. It's complete nonsense. Any frontline doctor who treats patients and genuinely listens to their patients, they know this is nonsense. So really, there is a big battle going on really a moment about how much we can even trust medical evidence, Pete. And one of the things I talked about in the European Parliament a couple of weeks ago is that the situation has become so dire that our healthcare system has been corrupted by commercial influence and it's broken and no amount of money will fix it. It really needs an overhaul. And that also means actually making sure we produce, you know, reliable data that doesn't have industry influence over it in terms of, you know, what determines guidelines, that people on guideline panels haven't got conflicts of interest where they've got financial ties to the drug industry. And once we get to that stage, then we can actually start practicing better medicine that truly puts patients first, Pete.
You talk about the guidelines, and today I was on our national television talking about our new documentary, The Magic Pill, which is on Netflix at the moment in the UK and the US and Canada and Australia and New Zealand to start with. And one of the hosts said, well, what are we doing wrong? And I said, well, the guidelines in our country, in Australia, are very wrong. I mean, they're promoting 6, sometimes up to 8 serves of grains per day. And I would love to hear from your point of view where you would like to take the guidelines and with your acquaintances and colleagues and what you would like to pitch to the population, because obviously there'd be an ideal, but is it going to be a gradual change that you would like to see throughout the education system and the hospital system and through the national guidelines?
Pete, I think first and foremost, Pete, I think the quicker we get the change, the better. I have no doubt in my mind that the flawed dietary guidelines that put, you know, starchy carbohydrates at the base of the diet has actually been responsible for the twin epidemics of type 2 diabetes and obesity, and have also worsened your cardiovascular risk. I have no doubt about that at all. And before we talk about changing the guidelines, let's just see where the science, what the science and the totality of the evidence tells us at the moment. I wrote a piece in the British Journal of Sports Medicine last year, which became one of the most read of any medical journal, BMJ journal piece of that year. And just to give it some sort of context, rather than it just being Dr. Asim Malhotra say so, I co-authored it with two very eminent cardiologists. One of them is the editor of JAMA Internal Medicine, Professor Rita Redberg in California. And the other co-author was Pascal Meyer, editor of Open Heart, now based in the UK. And we basically said there needs to be a complete shift in the paradigm of the understanding of heart disease. First and foremost, very clear, saturated fat, eating dietary saturated fat does not clog the arteries. It does not cause heart disease. The totality of evidence tells us that's very clear. The second thing is that we should stop focusing and being obsessed with low cholesterol. And third and most importantly is that actually lifestyle changes, dietary changes are more powerful than any drug in the prevention and treatment of heart disease and come without side effects. We talk about the dietary guidelines. The reason the dietary guidelines changed in the 70s and 80s, Pete, was because of the fear of heart disease. So the dietary guidelines are all based upon the fear of heart disease. And actually, when you look at the science, we have to look at what does actually cause heart disease or what's the best possible explanation. And if we understand that, then we can work on the solutions. And heart disease is a chronic inflammatory condition. It's driven by a combination of insulin resistance, which is essentially body becoming resistant to insulin over time, which is driven by poor diet, which puts starchy carbohydrates and refined carbohydrates and sugar at the top. So those are the things to avoid. And it's also other things such as poor sleep, stress, a sedentary lifestyle, so prolonged sitting. So we have the solutions. 80% of heart disease is lifestyle related. If we concentrate on those lifestyle factors, Pete, then we will sort this, you know, this crisis out, because actually these same root causes are also driving obesity, type 2 diabetes, responsible for about 50 to 70% of people having high blood pressure. So many of these chronic diseases will be curbed if we put those lifestyle changes at the forefront. Now, you asked about diet specifically. All the data I've looked at, certainly when you look at the traditional Mediterranean diet, I've studied and published on what are the components of the diet that are actually probably going to be beneficial from a heart disease perspective. And we say lots of vegetables, preferably non-starchy, you know, olive oil, nuts, oily fish, less of the refined carbs, moderate consumption of, you know, saturated fats from dairy products, no problem. And if you follow that kind of dietary pattern and, you know, and walk 30 minutes a day and try and concentrate on good social interaction and getting a good sleep, you know, you're most of the way there, Pete. So this really is what we need to focus on. One of the other problems as well is that when you look at the dietary guidelines that promote starch and, you know, had promoted sugar really for a long time as well, that's actually driven a consumption of not whole foods that happen to be low in fat. Because if you take most vegetables, Pete, and you break them down, they're not high in fat, right? Not to say fat's a problem, but you could follow a low fat diet, which doesn't have processed foods, and it could be relatively healthy. I've no doubt that could be relatively healthy. But actually what's happened is it's driven this market of low fat junk foods. So people go in and buying processed, you know, carbs and bread and, you know, eating lots of pasta and sugary sauces. And you add all that together, it's a metabolic time bomb. Mm-hmm. And that drives insulin resistance. And insulin resistance is the number one risk factor for heart attacks. And yep. I think that's very clear in terms of the evidence that we have at the moment. So what we need is a complete overhaul of the dietary guidelines, Pete. You know, we need to stop fearing fat. We need to concentrate on whole foods. And we need to really reduce the amount of starch people are eating. You know, traditional Mediterranean diet, I wrote a book called The Pioppi Diet, which was based upon this southern Italian village where things sort of may have gone slightly wrong because Ansel Keys, the architect behind the Mediterranean diet and the low-fat food movement and, you know, the movement to say we should lower saturated fat, he spent a lot of time in this village in southern Italy doing research there. And we went there to look at what were the kind of lifestyle factors and how do we marry that with the research. But what was interesting was, you know, people come back to me and say, hold on, Asim, you know, you've written about this Pioppi diet in southern Italy, but you're saying cut out pasta and bread and all that kind of stuff for the first 21 days. Well, if you're insulin resistant, if you're type 2 diabetic, mm-hmm. if you're overweight or obese, the first things you need to cut out are really those starches and those sugars. But when you look at that diet, if you're not in that situation, Pete, actually, when you look at the amount of starch they were consuming, pasta was never a main course in the traditional Italian diet. It was a small starter with olive oil. They didn't have snacks in between. They weren't eating any sugar. Pizza was eaten, you know, once a fortnight. Yeah. And they were outside. And if you're actually in that particular category, then eating that dietary pattern is probably not going to harm you. The other thing is, you probably well know, Pete, the modern bread is very different to the type of bread these people used to eat. That used to be baked in the home. It has a different glycemic index. So mm-hmm. when you put all of that together, you know, it's quite clear where we've gone wrong. So one more thing I think was interesting to mention. When people talk about processed food, ultra-processed food, there was a paper in the BMJ recently showing the link between ultra-processed food and cancer. Yeah. And when there was a very nice pie chart in that BMJ paper that broke down the different components of what was ultra-processed food. Most of it, Pete, was starch and sugar. There was very little that came from fat. Most of the processed foods that we consume, when we think about cookies and cakes and crisps and all that stuff, most of it is refined flour, sugar, starch. That's the problem, because it's poor, as you know, it's poor in nutrition, it's not satiating, encourages you to consume more, and it drives up insulin resistance.
My next question for you, Doctor, is we have an organization in Australia called the Heart Foundation that a lot of people look for advice on how to deal with their heart and the health of their heart and their loved ones. And obviously it's an organization, and I've been vocal before in the past that they had a sort of a campaign on processed foods that you could basically get a tick on it. And a lot of these foods were actually quite high in sugar, low in fat, and they got the tick of approval. That's been eradicated, and it's been replaced with a new sort of star system. So a lot of people that go to the Heart Foundation are looking for advice on how to look after their heart, and they still believe that saturated fat is a no-go zone. So how do people decipher the information when our Heart Foundation, that is meant to be trusted, is, I guess, in my opinion and other people's opinions, and I'd love to get your opinion, is not up to date with nutritional science?
You know, Pete, it's a really good point. I think the first thing to say, one of the fathers of the evidence-based medicine movement is a guy called the late Professor David Sackett. Canadian physician, and he's considered one of the gurus or fathers behind our practice of evidence-based medicine, which involves individual clinical expertise using the best available evidence and patient preferences and values. But one of the things he wrote in his later years, he says 50% of what you learn in medical school will turn out to be either outdated or wrong within 5 years of your graduation. The trouble is no one can tell you which half, so you need to learn on your own. And I think one of the first things to say is to give benefit of the doubt to the Australian Heart Foundation is that I suspect that they are still, and we have this here as well, Pete, in the UK, the British Heart Foundation, that we need to call them out as well. They are preaching outdated and flawed science. Unfortunately, a lot of the people and experts who are involved in these recommendations, if you dig deep, you find that they have huge commercial influence from low-fat message, proven to lower cholesterol drugs, all that kind of stuff. That just makes the problem worse. So one, they, you know, it's difficult for them to admit they were wrong, or and they should. I mean, it's the right thing to do and to evolve and say things have changed. And it has made worse. It becomes even more difficult, Pete, when you've got people who are paying you and whose salaries or institutions are dependent on money from people who profit from that flawed message. Mm. You know, there's a saying that you don't bite the hand that feeds you. But ultimately, my duty as a doctor is to scientific integrity and my patients. But the real scandal we have, Pete, in healthcare is that those who have that responsibility to scientific integrity, such as, and that includes journals, medical institutions, organizations, they collude with industry for financial gain. And people need to stop being naive about this. And people need to stand up, and there needs to be doctors' leaders sticking their head above the parapet and calling out these organizations for being selective, cherry-picking data, not reflecting the totality of the evidence. Because if they continue to do this, they will be called out, and they will lose trust. And we do not want that. We do not want a situation where patients do not trust their doctors. You know, we need to really make medicine great again. And we need to do that by being open and transparent, removing conflicts of interest, and reflecting the totality of the data. So sadly, the British Heart Foundation and the Australian Heart Foundation, by pushing this flawed information, they are unwittingly causing considerable harm to the population.
So it goes without saying, I guess, that you have a positive outlook or an optimistic outlook for the future, Doctor?
Pete, you know, to be honest, listen, I believe, and I meet a lot of these people as individuals, they are good people. They want to do the right thing. It's a system that's failing us, you know, because we've allowed too much commercial influence over science, over charities, over organizations. But we need to overhaul that system if we're going to sort our healthcare. So I believe in the human spirit. I believe in the goodness of individuals. I think most people want to do the right thing. But really, there is a battle right now in healthcare. And, you know, Marty Angel, the former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, the highest impact medical journal in the world, who I spoke to recently and mentioned her in an article I wrote in The Guardian newspaper. She said to me, she said, seeing the real battle we have in healthcare right now is one of truth versus money. Hmm. Which side are you on? I know which side I'm on. I think most people want to be on the side of truth. But that information needs to get out there so people can challenge the dark forces that are keeping people fat and sick. And if we do that, we will win this battle, and we'll win it very soon.
I love that, mate. I really love that quote that your friend said. How I'd like to finish up with you, and I've loved having this chat, and I'm sure a lot of people will be like having those aha moments, or they'll be passing on this podcast to their friends and family and loved ones, is I'd love to know your recipes for life. Basically, a couple of ingredients that Dr. Asir Malhotra uses for himself and his family as something other than what you've spoken about tonight so far, but as something that is delicious for you and might be able to share it with our audience as to what brings joy into your life.
You know, I think a lot of us reflect and we go throughout life thinking about, you know, ultimately, you know, what, how do we find meaning in our lives? What makes us happy? I think, everything is linked together. You know, you can't take things in isolation. So the kind of food we eat, it does have an impact on how we feel, how we think, how we sleep, our energy levels. So I think we need to think, okay, let's concentrate on good nutrition first and foremost. Let's eat whole foods, you know. And I think that has a big impact. But together with all of that, for me, and to be honest, Pete, you asked about what makes me happy. You know what? You know, it's so great to speak to you. You know, you've been such an amazing figure in Australia. And the messages you've pushed. And, you know, for me, I love cooking. I mean, I really love cooking. I find it therapeutic, you know, even finishing shifts or about to go on a night shift over the years. You know, for me, it was a priority to eat something, cook some fresh ingredients and cook good food because I just find that therapeutic and I love doing that. So I love cooking. For me, that's one of my favorite things to do. And I love sharing that with people, you know, cooking for friends, family members. You know, there's a real pleasure and joy in doing that. So actually, that's one of the things I love doing. I love walking, getting outside, exercise. Just, you know, exercise is great for health. It's not, I don't think it's linked to obesity. I think there's very, very little link there, but it's about the way that you feel in your mind. You know, you feel relaxed, you're active. I think social interaction, Pete, I think the problem, one of the problems we've got modern day, and I think the challenges we have now, is dealing with an overload of social media, spending too much time on social media. And I think that has a detrimental effect on our interactions with our friends and our family members. And I think one of the things for me, I've come to the realization that actually one of the core components of being happy and what gives me pleasure is having meaningful relationships. And I think if you haven't got that, you have to focus on that more, because it's there. I'm sure it's out there for you. But to spend more time with friends and family and interact and not have the mobile phone on the table when you're sitting, you know, in a restaurant, or whether you're at the dinner table at home, put it away. Get rid of that phone. Look at the person you're speaking to. There's something to suggest that even having the phone on the table removes empathy from the conversation. So we are built to interact with each other. And actually that interaction, that sense of community, which is what we found in PRP, I think is one of the key components, not just for happiness, but for health. Because if you have strong relationships, Pete, it does mitigate. There is science and evidence that tells us that it mitigates the external stresses of life. And life is not always easy, and there are always going to be unpredictable factors that are going to come in. But if you've got strong, good relationships with people, you're going to be able to deal with them a lot better.
Mate, thank you so much for your words of wisdom. We love you and we appreciate your time that you've spent with us today. And I cannot wait to see you change the world of nutrition and the world of science and actually change these guidelines once and for all. I lend you all my support, and I know you are going to change so many lives. You already have. And keep doing what you're doing, brother. We love you.
Pete, you're an absolute legend. Thank you. It's a pleasure and honor to be on your podcast. And this is a team effort, mate. It's a team effort. So let's just keep going.
Cheers, brother.
The information, views, and opinions expressed in this podcast should not be treated as a substitute for nutritional, medical, or other advice by a qualified professional. Guests in this podcast express their own opinions, experiences, and conclusions. Nothing in this podcast should be used to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any medical condition. Neither Pete Evans nor any sponsor endorse any views, opinions, or conclusions expressed or shared in this podcast.